Oh, thank you. Well, okay. I want to change my whole talk, and I will discuss transference-based psychotherapy and mentalization and how they relate to DBT. However, I'm thinking that might not be a good idea because I actually do understand the point about not discussing other people's therapies. But I am going to make a few comments about theirs as I go, but I have to say I have nothing in my talk that remotely relates to psychodrama. So I want to say that I, when I was a postdoc, actually co-taught a psychodrama suicide crisis intervention class. So that's all I have to say about psychodrama. But it was taught in a behavior therapy program, just to let you know. All right, I'm going to talk about dialectical behavior therapy. And what I thought I would do, and I'm going to kind of rush through because I somehow thought I had 45 minutes. But that's all right. The beginning part's better than the end. I'm going to go through the development and evaluation. Just from the point of view of sort of what are some of the steps. I first want to just point out that, of course, no one does anything by themselves. We could all, you know, this is only one slide of names, and I could put maybe five other slides of names up, but I just want to be clear that I've been doing this for 30 years, and I've had a whole team all the way through. So the development evaluation of DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, for short DBT from now on, followed guidelines for stage model of treatment development set forth by NIMH and NIDA. I actually started this before they did it, but when they developed all their models, they used my grant proposals as the ones for everybody to practice on what was wrong with it and how could it have been done better. And I was involved in developing all of these guidelines in both places. So there's a really good set of guidelines set up, and I thought I would just kind of anchor for you the development of a treatment within a set of national guidelines for research on the development of treatments. In stage one development, which is sort of the very first stage, which all of us have done already, all three of the people that you, me, the other two people, Otto and Peter. The first stage is in the development where you try to generate a treatment manual, you standardize your manual, and you do your pilot test of your efficacy. Now, that's where I ended up going from being a straight behavior therapist to being a dialectical behavior therapist, was really at the treatment generation phase. As many people know, I took chronically suicidal people and was going to apply behavior therapy to them, cure them in, at the time, 12 weeks, and then have a different career. But the facts of the matter are behavior therapy blew up. And I will talk to you later, actually in a few minutes, about what actually happened with the standard, that's the 1970s standard behavior therapy, and cognitive behavior therapy of the 1970s. What happened, the model for this is that there's, in a sense, that problem behaviors, and by behavior, you've got to remember, behaviorists think behavior is all movement or action of an organism, like behavior of a star, you know, in other words, thoughts, mentalization, feelings, affect, emotions, physiology, heart beating. We consider everything behavior. So don't get confused into thinking that we think of behavior as like action, you know, walking and stuff like that, because thought is behavior, cognition is behavior, processing information is behavior, neural firing of the brain is behavior, the cells are behavior. We consider everything behavior. So one person told me once at a meeting not too long ago in personality disorder, he said, I just wanted to tell you, I think that's profoundly unfair. But nonetheless, that's how behaviorists think. So anyway, the basic idea is that there's a cue or a trigger, in other words, some environmental event or internal event, in a group of people who have an inability to regulate emotions. And emotions, as you know, is a complex systemic response of the total organism. So I'm not thinking emotion is just feelings, that's part of emotion, but I'm talking about the sort of total systemic response, which includes really all the systems. That the inability to regulate, and in particular the inability to regulate negative emotions, but also actually an inability to regulate positive emotions at times, leads a person to attempt to either escape or avoid the experience of emotion. And by to escape or avoid, they engage in problem behavior, which regrettably almost always works short term. So there's an immediate negative reinforcement. And so there's temporary relief, at which point, though, because there's not any fundamental relief and no fundamental change, the person simply is more dysregulated because they've just made their life usually worse than it was before. So generally, one of the problem behaviors is the avoidance of experiencing, and another part of the problem is the going after certain types of experiences and trying to get away from other experiences. Now, if you walk into and so suicide is the ultimate escape from negative emotions. Almost anyone you talk to will tell you they think they're going to feel better when they're dead. Really, ask anybody who wants to kill themselves. They always think, actually, it's going to be better after they're dead. Now, I just want to point out there's absolutely no evidence that that's true. And I point that out to my clients regularly, that there's no evidence, nor has it been in the New York Times. But in general, that is why people want to kill themselves. They want to escape, get away from, or get out of something that feels to them to be intolerable. And so if you move in with a focus on change, the first problem that I ran into with this particular group of people was there would be an extremely high arousal. Arousal would go up, a sense of being out of control would also go up. High arousal impairs all cognitive processing. The feeling out of control would lead to an intense effort for the individual to get in control, and therapy would be at a standstill. So I figured, okay, no problem, I'll quit change, and I'll go to acceptance, but it had exactly sort of the same problem, because a focus on acceptance with a person who is in the depths of despair and tragedy and trauma, if you try to move into acceptance, that essentially has the same effect of invalidating their suffering, at which point, and there's a lot of research on verification and validation, by the way, and invalidation of emotional states. This is just sort of the basic psychological research. It's not stuff I've done. Invalidation of a person's core concepts or emotions leads to high arousal and a sense of being out of control, and a person will immediately move to reduce arousal and get back in control. And so so acceptance wasn't working out either. So the solution was to try a dialectical balance where we brought in an emphasis on change, and we balanced that with an emphasis on acceptance. And essentially here, it was the therapist's set of strategies that had to get balanced. So the therapist, behavior therapy is really a technology of change, sort of across the board. It depends on which version you're in. You're either trying to change emotions, cognitions, action. You're trying to change something. And so it's a technology. And so I essentially I needed a technology of acceptance. So that's really what was brought in somewhat new to behavior therapy, or at least got articulated. However, a new problem, well, let me state this. So essentially, the therapy can be looked at as divided right down the middle, even though it's very arbitrary, by the way. But it's arbitrarily that you can look at communication strategies, which is not what you say to the client, but how you say something to the client, as either in a reciprocal, warm, engaging manner, which is sort of the usual thing in all the beginning textbooks on psychotherapy, kind of the empathic, validating, reciprocal sort of approach, versus the irreverent approach. And irreverence is really designed to jolt the patient off the track that they're on. So it's irreverence versus reciprocity. And then you can look at how does a therapist interact with other people around a patient. And with the patients that all of us deal with, we end up getting phone calls from other people. But in multimodal treatments, and especially when you're working in a system where you have groups, individual, daycare, this, that, and the other, therapists get together and talk. You know, you've got a lot of people that you're dealing with, all of whom are dealing with the same patient. So you've got to have some strategy for exactly how does a therapist, a primary therapist with a particular person, how do you interact with everybody else, their family, their parents, da-da-da-da. So I ended up having to develop a set of strategies. Environmental interventions, one. That means you go in and you actually make changes in their environment for them. It's a little bit like case management, standard case management. That's over on the acceptance part because almost always that's what the client wants you to do. So therefore, you're accepting their belief that they can't do it and you go do it for them. DBT almost never does that. However, every once in a while it does. If the client's unconscious in the emergency room, and they call you and say, what drugs did they take? And you know, and they're unconscious, a DBT therapist would tell the physician what drugs they took. However, if they were conscious, a DBT therapist would say, let me talk to the patient. And then they'd say, why aren't you telling him what you took? And what's going on there? And what are you doing there anyway? So that's consultation of the patient, which is where you consult with the patient about how to manage their both interpersonal environment, but also their treatment environment. So that's also somewhat unique in DBT because we put a lot of emphasis on consulting. Every therapist consults with every patient on how to get along with every other therapist. And then we have team consultation. and I'll talk more about that maybe later. At the core of the treatment is problem solving, which is all of behavior therapy, and I'll mention that in a minute, and validation, which people have been talking about. Validation, the best way to think about it is really the way Alan Frazetti talked about it, but also to look at the research on self-verification and verification. Validation, the reason I think validation brings down emotional arousal, which it does, we know that it does, is that one of the primary evolutionary functions of emotion is to communicate. And it's to mobilize and activate the body for action and to communicate to others. And so when you invalidate emotions, the emotion goes up because the function hasn't been met. And if you validate it, then the function's been met, at which point the emotion ordinarily goes down. So from an evolutionary point of view, at least, validation makes a lot of sense. Okay, however, I ran into a second problem, which was not only did all sorts of cues and triggers show up, of which there were multiple ones, not only were the clients emotionally dysregulated and could not regulate their own emotions or emotion, but by that I mean they can't regulate emotional action, emotional experiencing, emotional cognition, emotion sensations. But if you started to work on any given problem, another problem would show up. And if you went to the other problem, then another problem would show up. And whatever it was the therapist went to address, the client would have some other problem that was more extreme than the one that you just decided to address. And the problem here was, first of all, this is just the data from our current study that we just finished, where you look at the people in my population that I just finished treating. 75% had major depression, 26% substance dependence, 51% PTSD, 16% with social phobia, 40% with panic disorder, 20% with OCD, and about 24% with eating disorder. So they're a very heterogeneous, multi-problem, systemically disordered group of people. And if you try to hit any one problem, you're going to run into trouble. So the problem being that if you want to work on problem one in your life, and really focus on it, any problem, you've got to somehow be able to tolerate other problems in your life. Put them on a shelf or figure out a way to not deal with them right this minute and deal with problem one. And this is exactly what this group could not do. They could not deal with one problem because they could not put anything else on a shelf. And they had what could be thought of as extremely low distress tolerance. And this is just a little bit of data by Martin Bohus on this very point with the borderline symptom list, which is a really great measurement that they've developed, which is incredibly highly related to diagnosis, as it turns out. And they show that in just an inner-city residential treatment-seeking drug users group, the more high the person was on borderline symptoms, the lower they were on a measure, experimental measure of distress tolerance. So there were a couple of solutions to this, and the main solution was to teach two sets of new behaviors. Not only did I have to help the clients become able to change themselves to self-regulate their own emotions and self-regulate and manage their own behavior, but I also had to figure out a way to get a client to be able to tolerate and radically accept themselves as they are while they're changing things to be more what they want to be. So in a sense, what we have to do is help our clients both accept and learn how to accept and tolerate the moment that they're in while they change themselves to achieve whatever goals the client happens to have. The second solution was to organize primary targets in treatment by levels of disorder. This levels of disorder I've published, but I haven't really talked that much about it, and those who know DBT know about it, but it's the notion of this, that patients come. I was really developed this primarily. I was trying to figure out why is it that we get in all these fights about what treatments work, and what are these battles about? Because half the time you think you're talking about apples and oranges, but really part of the time what you're doing is you're treating completely different levels of disorder. that if a person comes in severe behavioral discontrol, they're completely out of control, you are simply going to have to get that person in control before you can do anything else. There is going to be no choice. If a person walks in with a gun to their head saying, I'm going to pull the trigger, there's no therapist in the world who's going to say, by the way, did you do your homework? Or, what are you thinking about me right this minute? Okay, well, you might say that, actually. I could imagine myself saying that. But I probably wouldn't say it that way, in that particular tone of voice. But nonetheless, you're going to deal with the fact that they've got a gun to their head. If you've got a person who's psychotic and can't process information, you're going to get them processing information. You can't move further. Now, with borderline patients, ordinarily, if you get them in control, some people, once you get in control, they're just fine. You know, a toxic psychosis, for example, you cleanse the system, they're not psychotic, and they go home, and they jump out of all levels of disorder. Borderlines rarely jump out if you get them in control. They go to what I call the stage of quiet desperation. And the stage of quiet desperation is where the person's not out of control. Their problem is that they experience life as terrible, as in the state of quiet desperation. And really the problem here, and this is where it's actually quite, I think, compatible with mentalization. I'm not sure, you'll have to tell me. But here, what we really focus on is decreasing experiential avoidance. And what you have to do is decrease experiential avoidance of thought, of emotions, of feelings, etc. And the idea is, and there's a lot of research on the role of experiential avoidance in psychopathology. And essentially, the assumption here is that the problem is experiential avoidance. It's very much a model like PTSD, where the problem in PTSD is essentially avoidance, an avoidance problem. And the treatment for PTSD is exposure. And essentially, level two, the treatment is exposure. And it's exposure where you can reflect or observe or notice, which is what mindfulness is all about, is teaching you how to step back and notice an experience, as opposed to be lost inside the middle of the experience. And then we go to level three, which is problems in living. I'm not going to go over the research on that, but for Axis 1 stuff, ordinarily, is problems in living when it's not debilitating. And DBT has a couple of randomized trials now for eating disorders, binge eating, bulimia, where it's been really successful. And I'm not going to talk about those. I can tell you that if you take those treatments, the Axis 1 DBT treatments, and try to apply them to borderline DBT, they will blow up in your face. So don't do that. And then finally, level four is a stage of incompleteness where the goal is the capacity for freedom and joy, with freedom being sort of the ultimate, the freedom from needing to feel any particular way or to be any particular way or to have what you want, which will necessarily, in effect, lead to joy. Okay, all the research is on levels one and two. In all of our research, clients go from level one to level two. We've never done a study where we selected people for level two, but other people have. Okay. In level one, the targets are suicidal, life-threatening behaviors, therapy-interfering behaviors of either the therapist or the client, so we consider behaviors of the therapist just as much on the table in treatment as behaviors of the client. Quality of life interfering behaviors, which are severe, and what we're trying to do is increase all of that with skillful behaviors. So, standardization, you know, you have to have an adherence. You can't do research if you can't measure adherence. So, we have spent the last 10 years developing an adherence manual, because an adherence manual for a principle-driven treatment is very difficult to develop, as it turns out. They really don't exist. Most manuals are, did the therapist do A, B, or C? But DBT always is, if the patient did X, did the therapist do A, B, or C? So you have to have a principle-driven treatment requires you to observe the patient's behavior and then rate the therapist. So we've been working on our adherence. Essentially, we now have an adherence scale, 63 items. Items code really all of the strategies of DBT. Structural characteristics, validation, problem solving, behavioral assessment, didactic solution generation. Much of DBT is exposure. So in fact, I would say largely DBT is putting a person into the problems that they have, into the cues that create all the problems, and then working with them to be able to solve and get themselves regulated within those cues. contingency management, skills training, et cetera. So this is, you know, if you can read this way in the back, these are the strategies of the treatment. I don't want to go into them. The myth of adherence coding, especially, this is really important for those of you who are consumers in the audience and are going to be looking for DBT training programs, if you are, you need to remember that if a treatment's been developed and has an adherence manual, you don't want to have the myth that a person can just tell you whether something's DBT if they haven't had it coded for adherence. So that's really important. And we have a manual. We have reliable coders at the University of Washington and a couple of other places. And when in doubt, have a therapist send a tape. Because without adherence, obviously the adherence has to be by the developer of the treatment, or you don't know what it is. Without that, you really don't know what's being offered. Because you can call any treatment anything. So for the consumers here, you need to really be careful, because a lot of people are calling things DBT these days. And I know a lot of this isn't all over the country and in Europe, too. So this is just for those of you who are the scientists out there. We've got really good adherence reliability now. What I want to do is now look at just what's the data on the efficacy of the treatment. We've got six randomized trials in four independent labs. And the independent labs is really important, because if I was the only one getting these results, you always have your allegiance problem, which is you can't even claim. American Psychological Association won't even let you say a treatment's efficacious until independent lab has verified it. And so that's a really important thing. And so I'm happy that, DBT's been around for a really long time. So obviously a lot of people have been able to do research, and you have to be around a long time to get people to want to do research on you. So, but it's been effective across the board. I realize a lot of people keep saying and bringing up this quote of me in my article where I said the people are still miserable, and then people bring this up all the time. But the facts of the matter are there was clinically significant reductions in depression, hopelessness, suicide ideation that did not go back, that were stable and stayed there, and they came out of a clinical range in some of our other studies. So no one else has shown that they could get people less miserable, let's put it that way. Okay, mechanisms. I'm going to talk about the current study we're doing. I'll just briefly go through this. We just finished. We've just finished analyzing and writing this up. The key thing here was to look at the mechanism and see, is DBT effective because it's an expert psychotherapy done by expert people, or is it effective for some other reason? So we wanted to do a study looking at DBT, and I wanted a control condition that would control as much as possible to see if it was really unique to DBT that was causing this treatment to work. So we took a DBT condition, which was just standard. It's once a week individual, once a week group, telephone consultation. We never tell people to only call in a crisis, because our belief would be that they would just have more crisis. But they also can't call just any old time, so we're very like auto in the sense that if you call us for a reason we view as inappropriate, we talk it to death. And I will let all of you know, you can talk any problem to death if you pay your, do it. And we have our therapist group. The treatment by experts, which I'll explain in a minute, is individual psychotherapy as many times a week as the therapist wanted to give it or thought it was necessary. We paid to give them a consultation group, and they could put them in any treatment they wanted. Essentially, what we wanted to control for was therapist allegiance. So we wanted to get therapists and say, I'm paying you to do the very best therapy you can. You may do anything. You may put them on anything, put them in anywhere, and do anything you want. I want the best. We had to get institutional allegiance, because if it was just done at the University of Washington, then it's once again, who's going to trust a lot of research coming out of the University of Washington, since we're really a behavioral place. So we got the Seattle Institute of Psychoanalysis to agree, the training director at the Seattle Institute of Psychoanalysis, to be the supervisor for the treatment by expert group. And they have every bit as much institutional prestige as we do in Seattle. We wanted to get therapist expertise and experience, so what we did is we went to inpatient units, directors of all clinical training programs, directors of inpatient units, directors of outpatient units. We got directors of everyone, and we said to them, in effect, okay, from your experience observing people who do therapy in Seattle, who do you think are expert at treating suicidal borderline patients. We want the very best therapists in town. So we got this big list of people everyone would nominate, you know, psychiatry, social work, nursing. The best, of course, are heads of inpatient units. They really know who's good. And we sent them all a letter and we said, you have been nominated as an expert. Would you be a therapist in our research? So of course they all said yes. Then we gave them a questionnaire, and essentially we gave a long sort of evaluation of what kind of therapy they did, and we simply eliminated everybody who was behavioral. And we came up with six categories. And the categories that we put people in, that we put in the study was either completely non-behavioral, they did nothing behavioral, mostly non-behavioral, or usually non-behavioral. And we took them from the first two categories almost all the time. We wanted to match on gender. We wanted to have availability of supervision, so that's where the training director at the Institute of Psychoanalysis was. They were offered that and paid to go. But he was instructed that he wasn't to get them to do psychoanalysis, or he was to help them do their own therapy to the very best of their ability. That was his job. We paid the therapists all the same. We paid them to see the clients, and they all agreed to see clients for this amount of money for 1 year. The only thing they had to agree to is they had to agree to see them at least once a week, or schedule once a week. So they couldn't go below once a week. But they could go, I mean, some of them saw them five times a week. They could do whatever they thought was the best treatment. They could put them on any medication they wanted, et cetera. And we made sure every person got to the first appointment of their therapist. So that was a big problem in our previous study. And so we remedied that in this one. We wanted to control hours of individual therapy, and we wanted to control for general factors. So this is the expert psychotherapy group. And the question is if DBT is only an expert psychotherapy, or if all psychotherapies are equal, then we should have gotten the same results. So we're looking at these outcomes. The basic conclusion I'm going to tell you is that I think DBT probably is uniquely good with suicidal people. I mean, I think that's his greatest strength. We found that the suicide attempts were twice as high in the control condition as in DBT. In DBT, 23% attempted suicide at some point over the one-year treatment and one-year follow-up, and in treatment by experts, almost 47%, which of course was significant. When you just looked at every four-month segment, you know, was this sort of constant all the way through, you see that at every single segment, and we found a significant difference at every single four-month point, DBT had fewer suicide attempts. Now, that was both ambivalent and non-ambivalent suicide attempts. However, when you looked at just non-ambivalent, you found the exact same pattern. There were just fewer behaviors. So for both severe and very serious suicide attempts and for all suicide attempts in general, we found this finding. This is just the time to the first, so you see how many DBT is up there at top, and you can see that DBT people simply didn't attempt suicide as often. And the treatment by experts were pretty much attempting all the way through the one-year treatment. Now, everyone had to stop treatment at the 1 year. They had no option. There was no offer that you could keep coming back. We looked at the amount of treatment people got in the follow-up year, and they got an average of six sessions. So almost no, very little treatment was anyone getting, which is really quite amazing, because you'll see there's a real stability of change. There was no loss of gains in the follow-up year. And a lot of people said DBT doesn't have follow-up data, but it actually has a lot of one-year follow-up data, which may not be great, but it's longer anything else because it, you know, they weren't allowed to come back into therapy. So you can't really call a follow-up if you're still getting therapy. When you looked at emergency room visits, we were particularly interested in just, you know, maybe our people didn't attempt suicide, but that's because they all went to the emergency room. But when you looked at emergency room visits for ideation, this is not for an attempt, this is for ideation, twice as many also went to emergency rooms for ideation, treatment by experts, and really over twice as many, almost three times as many, more than three times as many went on inpatient units for suicide ideation. That's ideation without an attempt. You see a very similar pattern, but no significant difference in the follow-up year. So DBT sort of stayed where it was. Everybody actually just got better in the follow-up year. The big shock of the whole thing was that in non-suicidal self-injury, there was no difference. Now, this might be a power problem because, you know, you have to, we had 50 people per cell, 50 in one cell and 50 in the other. That's only 100 subjects. And that, you have to have a really very powerful treatment to get an effect with that small a subject sample. Most drug studies, you know, have 1 to 200 people in a cell. So it's possibly, but I don't think so looking at it. As you can see on this one, everybody went down. Now, DBT went down more, but not significantly. If we'd had a lot more subjects, that probably would have been, but it wasn't. And so we can't say that it is. And we would have to redo it to find out if that were true. So I'm going to tell you in a minute why I think this is true, because it's really important and definitely unexpected. I mean, the good news is treatment by experts is a lot better than treatment as usual. And if it wasn't a lot better, then you'd have to think there's something wrong with my study, because, you know, your treatment should come out like they've come out in other people's studies. When you looked at psychotropic medication, we did not force people to go off. We just told them we thought it'd be a good idea if they went off, and they should if they could. And essentially what happened was DBT significantly more often went off of all psychotropic medication. The really interesting part of it is that once they quit seeing us, somebody put them right back on meds. And there was no difference at that point. And they didn't get any worse on suicide ideation, depression, hopelessness, or any other measure at all, suggesting that medication might be much more a function of who's prescribing it than the patient. Medical risk of parasuicide during the treatment year, TBE. Whoops, I have this wrong. TBE had much higher medical risk. And they had a much higher medical risk during the first year. And during the second year, there was the medical risk was low for both. That's during follow-up. There was no difference in suicide ideation or reasons for living, but suicide ideation went way, got a lot better. And reasons for living got a lot better. Depression also went down to below clinical cutoff points. So they really zoomed way down in their depression. All of them did. Both groups did.
Dr. Linehan?
Okay, is it time? Yes.
We are about time.
Oh, yeah.
Questions.
All right. So the real biggest problem was dropout. This is perennially the problem. DBT always has a low dropout. This is one of the highest dropouts of any study, 25%. And I don't know of any other study with a dropout that high other than Cornell. Most studies are 15%, 8%, 10%. So this is pretty high. I want to just tell you one more thing. Maybe I'll skip it. We have a really fabulous measure now of remission from stage one. And when you looked at the end of the two-year follow-up period, if you looked at remission from out-of-control behaviors, DBT, with the same level of low, very low depression, DBT was significantly higher in the probability they would have no out-of-control behaviors for a period of 8 months. And we looked at remission as 8 months with no out-of-control behavior at all, of any sort, any of these. So I'll quit with that. Anyway, it's the best news is treatment by experts beats out treatment as usual. So if you can't find a DBT therapist, send them to a treatment by to an expert. That is, if you can't find transference-based or mentalization, then send them to another expert.
We have some questions for you. This first question says, I'm just starting DBT. In layman's terms, please describe your definition of validation. And then there is a second part to this. Is it appropriate for a person with BPD to read your skills manual?
You know, I didn't write the skills manual for patients. Thank God I didn't see anything disastrously terrible in it. So patients buy it all the time. Okay. So we're now writing one for the general public, more for patients. But for the moment, you can buy that one. What is validation? Well, in layperson's terms, validation is the communication to another person that their behavior, or behavior meaning everything, their thoughts, their feelings, their experience of themselves, their experience, you know, you have to assume everything, that what they've communicated to you or what they are or who they are makes sense, is reasonable in the context of things. That, so it requires that you actually hear it, because obviously if you didn't hear it, you'll miscommunicate back, that you understand what they're communicating, and that you communicate back that it makes sense. There's a level at which you also can normalize it and say, not only does it make sense, but it's normal. But you can also validate at the level of saying, that makes sense, but it's got to change. It's problematic in the extreme. And so a behavior can make sense because all behavior is either learned, because learning is just changed by experience. All behavior is either learned or it's biological, one or the other. I mean, all behavior is caused. And so the job of the person who's validating is to communicate that you've heard it and it's understandable. I hope Alan thinks that's a good definition.
Why did both groups do the same after 2 years? What does that say about the difference between expert therapy and DBT?
What that says probably, I think, is that that expert therapy will work if you give it a long time to work. But really what we found was much more interesting than that. And this exact same finding has been found in behavioral activation compared to cognitive therapy. And I'd be really interested in looking at the data from these other studies. What we actually found was this. DBT had a very small standard deviation, meaning that it not only worked, but it was basically uniform in its action across everybody. It tended to help almost everyone. Whereas the other two treatment as usual and treatment by experts both, some people were wildly helped by it. And other people either got worse or weren't helped at all. There was a much more variable response in the other treatments. And so part of the reason for the non-significance in findings is that you have, you need a much bigger sample size. In other words, to find these differences out at 2 years. But I do want to point out to you, there is no treatment study of any treatment where you don't ultimately find people not getting treatment start getting better because they get a lot of other treatments.
This is sort of related to this. Why do you say that it's better to go off medications when a patient is with a DBT therapist?
Oh, I don't. That's a really good question. I actually don't believe that at all. I don't think. But the reason we take them off medications because the National Institute of Mental Health funds my research, and they told me I had to, because they said I was not a biological researcher, and therefore I could not do it, and that I therefore had to take them off medication. And so I didn't have much choice. Now the facts of the matter are. Most of the things people are on medication for, DBT targets, like depression, DBT has within it. You know, cognitive behavioral treatment is as effective as any medication. I mean, there's no reason to believe cognitive behavioral treatment is not effective for depression, and DBT would treat depression. For all the anxiety disorders, DBT would treat them. So it's not, DBT doesn't really ignore an Axis 1 disorder. The place that DBT would not target, or right now, at least, I don't think, is schizophrenia and bipolar, although I have to admit Steve Hayes' treatment, which is very similar to DBT, has got really unbelievable results with schizophrenics. So, you know, it's this experiential, teaching them to experience, to watch their thoughts. And DBT does a lot of teaching you to watch things. So, you know, patients, there's no research you need to remember on polypharmacy. I mean, there are no studies showing that what our patients take is effective. The research on pharmacotherapy is on one medication at a time. And so all of our patients are doing treatments that have no basis in the research at all that they would be effective. And so at least you might want to think about having a person, you know, kind of titrating them down from their meds and then starting back over and really finding out if any of these medications they're on actually are effective. I don't think you need as many meds with DBT either.
Given the focus on behavior in DBT, could you highlight some key differences between DBT and cognitive behavioral therapy?
You know, the real difference, DBT pays attention to cognition. We don't, DBT is cognitive behavior therapy, by the way. So they must have met between cognitive therapy, which is also cognitive behavioral therapy. The thing that they're finding, research study after research study now is finding, that when you take restructuring of thoughts out of a treatment, the treatment appears to not only work as well, it works faster. That spending very much time talking about whether a person's cognitions are the content, the meaning, the content of thought, doesn't appear to be altogether that important. Because when you take it out of a therapy, the therapy works just as well as when you put it in. So DBT doesn't spend loads of time on the content of thought. But what it does spend a lot of time on is teaching a person to be less reactive to their own thoughts. So that, in a sense, you want to be able to let thoughts go through your mind, and you don't have to have such a major, you know, emotional reaction to just because some thought went through your mind. So we pay a lot more attention to changing your reaction to your thoughts than we do changing your thoughts.
Okay. How can you, this is a question about really the follow-up phase of your protocol. How can it be ethical to forbid people from seeking therapy during the follow-up year?
Oh, sorry about that. We don't. We forbid them from seeking it from us or anyone associated with us, which basically rules out DBT. So a person can absolutely get treatment anywhere else. And generally what we say is that 4 months, we do our next assessment 4 months, that after their 4 month after follow-up, they could negotiate to come back into therapy with their therapist. It's just that no one did, and in this latest study. And we really have to look far more closely at our results, because this study had such dramatic improvement in psychopathology, you know, depression, suicide ideation, anxiety, anger, all of that kind of stuff, that stayed so stable over the follow-up year that we actually have to go look and try to figure out how did this work so well? You know, have we gotten better or what? So it actually had really stunningly good outcomes, if I do say so myself, but I don't know why exactly. So I think that our therapists we've gotten much more mindful ourselves. We're much better at this observing and focusing, and we're more focusing on exposure and stepping back and observing than we used to be.
This is another one that's requesting that you speak a little bit about the treatment methods rather than how you got to where you got to in terms of your DBT theory. But what exactly are your treatment methods?
Well, to start out with, their standard behavior therapy. Okay, so, and they have all the non, you know, all I really do that's different from many standard behavior therapies of the old days is things that are commonly called relationship factors in psychodynamic or non-behavioral treatments. You know, behaviorists just don't use those terms, so we just use different terms, but we pay a lot of attention to defining and specifying communication styles and behavior patterns. But the way the therapy goes, the patient comes in, and generally you ask them, you find out what's happened during the week, and then you prioritize what are the main problems that'll be worked on in the session. And generally, if the client has tried to kill themselves, wants to kill themselves, has high suicide ideation, that would be your first priority. If there's any behavior that's interfering with therapy, which boils down to anything they do that makes you not want to treat them, or anything you do that makes you not want them not be want to be with you, or anything going on at all in the relationship between the two of you that's problematic in any way whatsoever, that gets dealt with. And so the behavior within the room, you know, Otto talked about transference-based. Behaviors just look at transference as generalization. And generalization, behaviors look at all the time, which is this behavior in the room the same kind of problematic behavior that gets you in trouble outside of here? If yes, let's deal with it in here. Because obviously behavior you can see is a lot easier to target and treat than behavior you hear about. So you're a lot smarter to deal with what's going on in the room, obviously, it seems to me. It seems to anybody, I guess, than you are to deal with what you hear about. The problem is they usually aren't trying to kill themselves with you. And so you're going to have to deal with that. And so, and we do a lot of behavioral analysis, which is very minute, looking at moment-to-moment thought, emotion, feeling, events, sensations, physiology, the whole thing. You know, sort of the whole second-by-second rolling out of behavior. The difference between a behaviorist and most psychodynamic theorists is psychodynamic theorists tend to have a construct of depth. You know, this is deeper than that. And behaviorists don't have a construct of depth. We don't use that construct. We have a construct of time. And we look at what happened before what. You know, it's more like a chain reaction. We're always looking at the chain reaction of this to that. In awareness and out of awareness. I mean, behaviorists, goes without saying that half of what goes on in the universe is interesting, we're not aware of. So what else do we do? We do skills training. We're doing a study right now to find out if that's important. We do a lot of exposure, which is we recreate the cue that creates the problem, keep the person in it, make sure that we don't let the cue go away, and then assist the client in figuring out how to regulate themselves and get themselves, well, they don't have to figure it out, they just have to do it, get themselves regulated within the cue. So one of the main things DBT therapists do is not remove cues. I had to say what's one of the single biggest mistakes other therapists make is if a client gets upset with you, for example, then you remove the cue right, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, as opposed to leaving the cue in place and helping the client regulate. So, I mean, I could go on, you know. What we do depends mostly on what the client does.
You know, we're just about out of time, but I want to, okay, we're out of time.
Okay.
All right. I won't ask this last question. I'll put it on the web.
Oh, what is it, though? Now
it's about the role of family in DBT, but we'll put it on the web.
Oh, no, I take it away.
Oh, she took it away.
Oh, no, I'll just say
would.
Family in DBT, which is this. Adolescents,
I thought you would.
All skills training with adolescents, you do it with families. Adolescents, this is really important. There's no adolescent DBT person that doesn't say you have the families involved in it. I don't do adolescent DBT, except for 18-year-old and older. It's because I don't understand adolescents.
Thanks very much. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Linehan.